If there's a sleepy, grumpy child or adolescent in your life, you're not alone. Sleep problems are quite common, and physicians and psychologists estimate that as many as 40% of children may have a sleep disorder at some point in their lives. Sleep is essential for overall good health in children and adolescents, accounting for approximately 40% of a child's typical day. And when children and adolescents do not get enough sleep, aspects of their physical, emotional, cognitive, and social development can be greatly affected, leading to all types of difficulties. So what's a parent to do? Well, joining me this morning to shed more light on sleep disorders and what can be done about them is Dr. Courtney DuMond, a clinical psychologist with the Department of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, specializing in treating children with behavioral sleep problems. Welcome, Dr. DuMond.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in today. So let's start out first, because I think this is something that is kind of a myth in our society or a poorly held fact. What is the normal amount of sleep we should see at various ages in children in children's lives?
Well, we can start at the beginning with infants. And in infancy, we see an enormous amount of variability, and that's completely normal. So some infants sleep closer to 10 hours, where other infants may sleep up to 20. So at that time, there's a huge amount of variability. There's also variability in terms of when an infant will get that sleep. Some infants will sleep mostly at night, while other parents you'll commonly hear say that their infants sleep mostly during the day, much to their chagrin. As we get into toddlerhood and preschool, we can see anywhere from over 24 hours, 10 to 13 hours of sleep, and that includes their daytime naps. And there's a lot of variability there too as well. Some kids may take two naps, some kids may take one, and from those ages of 3 to 5, you'll see those naps fade from 2 to 1 to none over time. But usually at night, kids get about 9 to 10 hours of sleep during these ages, and that's appropriate. School age, we'd like to see between 8 and 10 hours of sleep. And at this time, daytime naps would be highly atypical. This age child should not be sleepy during the day. So if your school age child is sleepy during the day, that's a good warning sign that something's up with their sleep. And in adolescence, unfortunately, what's typical is not enough. Adolescents don't get nearly as much sleep as they need. They actually require 9 to 9.5 hours of sleep, but our adolescents get far less than that.
Yeah, I think we've been seeing more and more how, in general, in our country, there is this kind of notion that we need less sleep. And even there's this, I don't know, almost machismo attitude that the less sleep you get, the stronger you are in some ways. And I think adolescents get particularly affected by that.
Absolutely.
So how do you know if a child has a true sleep disorder and it's not just part of their developmental staging? Mm-hmm. What are the criteria?
I think there are lots of different criteria for different disorders. But as far as if a parent is looking at their child and wondering, is something wrong with my child's sleep? One of the main warning signs is daytime sleepiness, especially if they're getting enough sleep. So if we have a school-aged child who sleeps 9 to 10 hours, and yet they're still sleepy during the day, there's probably something wrong with their sleep.
So you're saying qualitatively their sleep is not satisfying their body's needs.
Right, exactly. So there may be a sleep disruptor there, such as obstructive sleep apnea. We can have leg movements during sleep that disrupt our sleep. And then the other way that parents know is the things that bother them about their child's sleep. So often they may notice that it takes their child a very long time to fall asleep, and that there's a lot of parental involvement in order to get their child to fall asleep, or that their child frequently wakes up at night, and that can disrupt sleep and lead to daytime sleepiness as well. So there's all sorts of different warning signs, but I would say the primary one is that the child's sleepy during the day, that they notice that. And in kids, the important thing to know is that sleepiness doesn't look the same as it does in adults. So when you and I are sleepy, we look sleepy. And in kids, they often look hyper instead of sleepy, or irritable, grumpy, moody, but they often get extra energy or hyper when they're really sleepy.
Now, so that's very interesting, mm-hmm. And I'm sure most people, it's counterintuitive, so
exactly.
I think most people wouldn't think that.
Absolutely.
So what do you think that, you mentioned a few, but what then would be the causes for these kinds of interruptions in sleep? You mentioned mm-hmm. just a few. Can you elaborate?
There are things such as obstructive sleep apnea or the leg movements. Those are biological. Obstructive sleep apnea is breathing problems during sleep.
And those are caused by being overweight. I know in adults that's true.
They can be. They can also be caused by enlarged tonsils and adenoids, different abnormalities in the airway. Children with a developmental disabilities are more likely to have them due to craniofacial abnormalities. So there's lots of different reasons why a child might have them, and snoring is a good warning sign that that might be going on. As far as the behaviorally based sleep disorders, there's lots of different things that cause those, and they vary at different ages. For a child that wakes up frequently at night, usually what we find is that there's something about how they are generally put to bed that creates a negative, what we call a sleep association, that then they require again when they wake up in the middle of the night. And that most common sleep association is a parent. So a parent is with them in one form or another when they fall asleep. And when they wake up across the night, which is normal, we all wake up during our sleep cycles about 4 to 6 times a night. And when they have that normal awakening, they don't know how to put themselves to sleep because they're always put to sleep by a parent. So they don't know how to fall back asleep by themselves, and they require the parent to come back in and intervene, which is often problematic for the parent.
So those are the ones that you consider behaviorally induced. There's not a biologic reason for it.
Exactly.
It's a learned behavior.
Right. And same with the children that resist bedtime. So again, that's more behaviorally based. They may end up with, you know, up to 2 hours that they stay awake past their bedtime, you know, asking for another glass of water, another hug from daddy, and kiss the cat goodnight, and all these different things just to prolong going to bed.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought because,
I'm
really interested in that, and I think we're going to come back and talk specifically about what you do for that kind of problem. But we have to take a short break. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen, along with my guest, Dr. Courtney Dumond, and we're talking about childhood sleep problems. Well, before the break, Dr. Dumond, you were explaining, you know, the kinds of things we would see with children who had behaviorally induced sleep problems. For example, hyperactivity would be something we would see as a consequence. But there must be more and a wider range of consequences to poor sleep habits or sleep disorders. So tell me, what else do we see?
So the one that you bring up first is the hyperactivity or inattention. So children who are low on sleep have a hard time paying attention, concentrating, and therefore learning in school. So we often see children with sleep disorders having declining grades. So an A student is now a B or a C student because they're not getting enough sleep and they just have a hard time learning. We also see behavioral consequences to sleep disorders. So just like you and I, when we don't get a good night's sleep, we're moody, we're grumpy. It's hard for us to behave and regulate our behavior.
Or even cooperate, I would think.
Exactly.
If asked to cooperate or wait, you know, have some degree of kind of, you can become more impatient and to learn to be patient obviously requires
impulse control is,
impulse
is out
control.
The window.
Right.
And the same with emotions. So they struggle to regulate their emotions. They can be very moody. And as you can imagine, these cause consequences not just for the child, but for the family as well. The child is grumpy and moody. It's harder to regulate their behavior. The parent is likely up with them at night, so the parent is also sleep deprived, and they're moody and
talk
grumpy
about
and have a heart.
A synergy of effects.
Absolutely. And we've actually found in studies that when we improve a child's sleep, we improve family functioning, we improve mom's mood, and all sorts of things.
So no surprise.
Absolutely.
Having been there.
Yeah.
So do you also see, I read somewhere that you can also see things like obesity showing up with childhood
so
sleep problems.
There are
Why
also multiple health consequences. Well, there are some hormonal things that happen during sleep. Ghrelin in particular is regulated during sleep. So
what is that, a hormone?
It's a hormone related to appetite and obesity. Mm-hmm. And when children don't get enough sleep, one, there's more time awake during the day to eat. They're hungrier. They crave more sugars and carbohydrates. And that's still highly under investigation. They're looking into it, but there are lots of things about not getting enough sleep that relate to obesity. They're too tired to exercise, lots of different reasons.
Yeah, it would strike me that that would be a big one if you're so tired. Or I remember the term when I was raising my kids, overtired.
Right.
You know, it's like
it's
what you've described is of a child being so-called hyperactive, mm-hmm. as being someone who hasn't had enough sleep, and yet they're like going, and then they have no tolerance for anything.
Absolutely.
So I can see that being a huge problem. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, clearly what you're doing with your, you know, most of your patients is intervening with these behavioral kinds of problems. So what can you do? What do you do?
It depends on the type of sleep problem and on the age. So in little kids, so usually we wouldn't treat a sleep problem until about 6 months of age, but 6 months up through about school age, so about five, we see a lot of behavioral sleep problems. Some of the most common are what I alluded to earlier, the sleep associations. And again, that's when there's something that's present when the child falls asleep. And when the child wakes up, which is normal during the night, they need that association back to fall asleep. So just like you and I fall asleep with our pillows and our blankets, these children are usually put to sleep with a parent present. They may be nursing to sleep. They may be singing, rubbing them, massaging them while they fall asleep, or just lying next to them. But when the child wakes up in the middle of the night, they haven't learned that skill of how to put themselves to sleep independently. So they need the parent back, or they need to be fed again in the middle of the night to fall back asleep.
So at certain ages, this sounds fairly typical, you would mm-hmm. think some of that behavior is appropriate on the part
Absolutely.
Of the parent.
Absolutely.
But then at a certain point developmentally, mm-hmm. that needs to be somehow weaned away.
Absolutely. So in
how
infancy,
do you intervene?
That's very typical yeah. when a parent would come feed the child during the night. But when the child should sleep through the night at 2 or 3, and they're still requiring parental intervention. We use a variety of techniques. I work with families to start kind of where they're at.
That's always good.
Right. And most parents, by the time they get to my clinic, they've tried cried out. They've done that. They've done the Ferber method or different things and really struggled to implement that. So
let's back up. Mm-hmm. When you say cry it out, because I can remember in the days of raising my children, mm-hmm. I remember reading things that say if the baby's already slept through the night and all of a sudden they're getting up again, you need to just like white knuckle it through the night and let the baby cry mm-hmm. it through. And you're saying it doesn't work?
Or it does work. It works for many children. But for a lot of children and a lot of parents, it's just too tough. It generally, for a healthy child, will work if the parent can really stick with it and do it. But it's really, really hard to listen to your child cry. And a lot of children might get to the point where they cry until they vomit or something like that. That's very scary for a parent. So typically when I see parents, they've tried that and it hasn't worked for one reason or another. So we take a more gradual approach. There are a couple of ways to do gradual approaches. We might have a scheduled checking where the child is only allowed to cry for a certain period of time before the parent goes in and checks. Or another thing I use commonly, if I have a mom who is nursing a child to sleep while rocking them in a rocking chair and then putting them into their bed awake, I might just gradually reduce those sleep associations. So I would still have the mom nurse at bedtime, but just nurse earlier in the bedtime routine so that the child doesn't fall asleep while nursing. And then for a while they would still rock the baby to sleep. Then they might just sit in the chair and not rock the baby to sleep, and then slowly get that child to where they're falling asleep independently.
So the notion here is that you're weaning that association off so that the parent is no longer essential for that child to self-soothe or
Absolutely.
Put themselves back to sleep.
Absolutely.
And at what ages does that, I mean, first of all, have you had a good deal of success with these types of methods?
Absolutely. We're very, very effective in treating this type of sleep disorder, which is the good news. They're incredibly common is the bad news. But the good news is that behavioral interventions are very, very effective in treating these. We see success in over 85% of the cases, and it really lasts.
Tell me again the age ranges that you're generally intervening and where it works best.
Well, for the sleep association, the most common ages are in the earlier kids. But we certainly do still see kids in the school age, you know, a 10-year-old who still needs a parent to help them fall asleep. So sometimes we're treating sleep associations in those ages as well. More commonly in those kids, we see what we would call limit setting problems, which is that bedtime struggle of the back and forth and the curtain calls before going to bed, where it might take a child hours to fall asleep just because they're resisting. And we use similar types of behavioral interventions to intervene there.
Again, trying to get appropriate limits being set. But
Absolutely.
How about if there are fears that are undermining that process. In other words, obviously the separation is what's at the root of it.
Right.
I mean, on a kind of an existential level,
right.
The child needs to know that they will survive being without the parent through the night and be able to put themselves to sleep and sleep through the night.
That's a very good point. So we often see anxiety and sleep are highly intertwined. And one of the things I do is to try to tease out which one is primary. So is this primarily a sleep problem that causes a little anxiety? Or is this a child with a full-blown anxiety disorder in which sleep is a symptom of that? And then I'll treat whichever is primary as my focus. So a child who's really anxious in a variety of situations during the day and the night, my focus would really be on treating the anxiety disorder that underlies it. Whereas a child that just has nighttime fears and isn't anxious the rest of the day, then I would more intervene on their sleep problems and try to come up with different things that would help them cope with those nighttime fears. And we often get very creative there and take advantage of the kids' imagination.
Yeah, give us some examples.
A very common, normal, typical childhood fear is monsters under the bed or monsters in the closet. And kids have such active imaginations, which are what created these. So I always encourage parents to use the child's imagination to help get rid of them, because that's where they come from. So we often have parents decorate up a hairspray bottle or a water bottle and label it as monster spray. And then the child sprays the room before they go to bed with the monster spray that keeps all the monsters out, and the child is fine.
That's great. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll share with you one quick story. I had one child who was particular fears at night, and I developed the sword, the ring, and the shield, which were things that I gave him, not physically, but in his imagination, where he could put on the ring and become invisible. The shield would protect him, and the sword would be invincible. And I would always give them to him figuratively before he would go to bed and tell him that if any monsters came during the night or in his dreams, he had all the tools he needed. And in his case, it absolutely worked.
So that's a wonderful idea. That's perfect.
Yeah, that's using their imagination to actually help them develop a sense of empowerment or resilience.
Absolutely.
So that's fantastic. And it sounds to me like if you can manage to get the sleep under control, then a lot of these other issues that you raised do disappear.
Absolutely. It's an incredibly rewarding field to work in, because when you fix sleep, you fix a lot of other things. You improve family functioning, everybody's mood, how the child learns.
In the very little bit of time that we have left, what do you do with adolescents who say, I don't need to sleep?
Well, adolescents often have a lot of social pressures. So we work with them to help them prioritize sleep and meet them where they're at. If now they're going to bed at 2, we'll start with them going to bed at 2 and just work slowly to get them a little more sleep. And it's self-rewarding in the end. They feel better when they sleep more.
Well, Dr. Courtney Dumond, sleep specialist, clinical psychologist with the Department of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, you're doing such important work. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing all of it with us. We have to take a short break again, but we'll be right back. Please stay right with us. And I'm Linda Cohen, and this is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.